This is XTP Media.
Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
You're listening to Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to episode 48 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. This is an extra episode, so we have some interesting content for you today. We've got an interview with Chris Haywood from the Whirlwind Project, and Chris tells us about his little known Second World War RAF fighter. We've then got an interview with Jo Ayres, who tells us about her voluntary work for the Spirit of Great Britain and her passion for photography. We love aviation books here on Extended, and we got a review of Hawker Hurricane Survivors, the great new book on the remaining Hawker Hurricane airframes around the world. Our final segment today on this extra episode comes from the Flight Sim Centre with Neil McCarthy. Okay, let's get on with the show then. Our first guest is Chris Haywood from the Whirlwind Project. The Whirlwind's a great aircraft and it's a bit of an unsung hero from World War II. Here's Chris to tell us all about the project and the aircraft. And let me apologise for the line quality. I'd like to welcome Chris Haywood to the programme. And Chris is the secretary of the Whirlwind Fighter Project. Chris, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. The Whirlwind is an aircraft that some people know a lot about and many don't know anything about. I remember it from my younger days building Airfix models, I think. But Chris, to put this into context, can you tell us a little bit about the aircraft, where it came from and what it was used for?
Yes, of course. The Whirlwind was first designed by W.H.W. Petter, or Teddy Petter as he's otherwise known. And it was designed to the specification of F-37/35. Westland put forward a design called the P-9 for a twin-engined, single-seat, cannon-armed fighter for the RAF.
Okay, and this was pre-war, wasn't it? Pre-Second
World
War.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It was. 1937, I think it was. 36, 37.
Yeah.
The Whirlwind was designed around the Peregrine engine. The Peregrine developed between 860 and 885 horsepower up to 15,000 feet.
Right, okay.
It had a top speed of 380 miles an hour, which at that particular time was actually faster than the Spitfire Mark I.
Now, this was a single-seat fighter, wasn't it?
It was a single-seat fighter, yes.
And was it, Chris, was it designed as a fighter? Because I know it was used in several roles.
Yes, it was. It was original design was a fighter. But I believe because the engine, the Peregrines, ran out of steam over 15,000 feet, it was decided to put it into low-level attack.
Right, okay.
And they used it mostly in the Western approaches for shooting up E-boats and shipping.
Yeah.
Also attacking airfields and trains on the continent.
Right, okay. Because it carried a reasonable amount of armament, didn't it?
Yeah, there's four 20mm cannons. Not only was it faster than the Mark I Spitfire, it was more heavily armed.
Yeah.
I believe that the idea is that during the impossible invasion stage, that some of the whirlwinds, there were six whirlwinds kept up in Scotland, and they were to be kept in reserve as a tank busting.
Right.
Just in case the invasion naturally happened.
So they did start the Second World War in service. How many aircraft were made and were actually used? I've seen that fantastic video that you sent me, the Pathé News yep. thing, which sees them all lined up. It seems like an endless parade, but there weren't that many made, were there?
Well, the first few whirlwinds went to 25 Squadron for evaluation at North Weald for night fighting purposes. But all in all, 114 plus two prototypes was the total build of the whirlwind.
I thought it was more. I thought it was more than that.
That's all. It served in two squadrons, 263 and 137 Squadron.
Right.
And it stayed in service right throughout until 1943.
Yeah.
Just literally as the Mark One. There were no updates, no upgrades.
Right, okay. And why was it retired? Because it seemed like a pretty powerful aircraft. It seemed like it would have had a good run at ground attack and things like that. Why did they not progress the modifications to because I know there were things like approach speeds were challenging because it was a very fast approach and things like that. Why didn't they put some of those mods in that they were thinking about?
The actual problem, I believe, and this is one of the things that we found out as we've gone along, is that the Ministry wanted to concentrate on the Merlin engine.
Yeah.
Because the Merlin engine powered the Spitfire and the Hurricane, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And they wanted to go on that. Now, there was the possibility of redesigning the Whirlwind to take Merlin engines. However, this was would have had a total upset of the design itself because they would have had to rejig the fuselage and the centre of gravity and all the things that went with it.
Right.
So it really didn't work. And because they concentrated on the Merlin, Rolls-Royce stopped building the Peregrine. I believe there were only about 230 Peregrine engines actually built.
Right,
so of course, when that came to an end, yeah. There was nowhere for the Whirlwind to go.
It's a great sounding engine, though, isn't it, the Peregrine? You can hear the Rolls-Royce pedigree coming through.
Yeah. Once come on from the Kestrel.
Yeah.
And I think it was a double Kestrel that was joined together to make a Peregrine.
Right, okay.
The way they do it.
Right. Well, after the war, as we said, they had been retired. Tell us what happened between then and now, then.
Well, the Whirlwind, only one was actually kept on, and this was kept on by Westland as a hack and was finally struck off charge by Westland in 1947.
Right.
Up until that time, there were no Whirlwinds anywhere because they were all disposed of.
Right.
And reduced to produce over the years.
Yeah.
So there was nothing left. And it's always been like yourself, you know, one of my first aircraft I built as a kid was the Whirlwind.
Yeah.
And that's been with me all these years. And I know several of the other members of the team went the same way. They were all inspired by this single Airfix kit.
Yeah.
There was a discussion on Flypass Forum about the Whirlwind. And two of the team members, Matt Bierman and Mike Eastman. Now, Mike runs the aircraft restoration group.
Right, okay.
And they were having a discussion. It was a bit like Bob the Builder, basically. Matt said, can we build it? And Mike said, yes, we can.
Just to interrupt you then, yep. Chris, that then I'm assuming there weren't any whirlwinds that were kept then from post-Westland. They'd all gone, had they?
They'd all gone.
So no airframe survived?
Nope.
Right, okay.
The only parts that survived were of a crash in Stirlingshire that was dug up by Steve Vizard many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of Peregrines there, but they were pretty badly smashed.
Right, okay. So how did you get involved then?
Well, personally, again, I volunteered as a researcher for the group.
Right.
Then found in my researching skills weren't quite up to what I thought they were. and then somebody suggested, well, why don't we take this down a formal route? And I said, well, yeah, you know, I can do the secretary's work because I was secretary in other organisations over the years.
Right.
So I took the secretary's job on.
Okay.
We got a guy in Norway called Gunnar Olsen.
Yeah.
Who was an absolute brilliant CAD SolidWorks designer. We approached Westland and lay under the nard a bit because they'd had many approaches over the years.
Yeah.
Of people wanting to build a Whirlwind. But there was something about our approach that made them think, well, perhaps we've got something here.
Yeah.
And they gave us what plans they had left because they had a big flood many years ago and a lot of the plans were destroyed.
Right.
So okay. That left us with just a couple of plans to start with. Gunnar started looking at all the crash photographs, all the photographs of the Whirlwind using his measuring system.
Yeah.
I've now produced nearly a complete plan for the aircraft, for the fuselage, tail, cockpit section and the wings. And it's taken us 4 years to get this far.
Yeah. Now, he's producing the missing drawings, in effect.
Yes.
From scratch, isn't he? From he photographs is. And from other sorts of things. Chris, what's the objective then of the Whirlwind Fighter project?
The objective basically is to recreate a replica of the Whirlwind Fighter to static condition.
Right.
Can't fly it because it would not only cost too much.
Yeah.
But Westland sort of said to us, we'll help, but, you know. Yeah. You can't fly it. So we said, well, you know, a static one is better than nothing at all.
Right.
But this is the route we're going down.
Okay. And what's the plans for, I suppose, placement of the aircraft once it's once you're through the obvious tricky process of designing and building it? Where do you plan to house it?
We've had a couple of offers from people, museums in the country that are prepared to put it up, so to speak.
Yeah.
And what we do want to do originally is to tour it.
Right,
around some of the air shows, some of the museums, and make sure people get a chance to see it.
Yeah.
It's going to be able to be broken down into three components that are transportable.
Yeah.
And that is basically the plan behind it.
What's inspiring you guys to do this? Because, you've come across an aircraft that no longer sits in the inventory anywhere in the world. Sounded like an exciting thing. But what's inspiring you to make this a reality?
That's a good question.
Because some people will call you mad. Some people will call you mad. Some people will call you heroes. And everyone else is probably somewhere in that spectrum. It's an amazing project to pull together from scratch.
I think there's something about the Whirlwind. And to be totally honest with you, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's enthralled me since I was about 11. It's had the same effect on other members of the team.
Yeah.
The fact that it doesn't exist and it should still be around in one respect or the other, I think, is the thing behind it.
I'm surprised, Chris, that there isn't any evidence of the aircraft in one of the RAF museums.
No, well, so are we. This is something we want to try and put right.
Yeah.
I think one of my pet things is that, not detracting from the Battle of Britain or the bomber guys or anything like that, they all did a most incredible job.
Yeah.
And the job I wouldn't like to do, but there's a bit missing from the middle of the war of all the pilots that flew these type of aircraft that don't get recognised.
Yeah.
Guys, you know, sort of later went on to fly the Typhoon from 263 and 137 squadrons on Cab Rank over in Normandy and places like that.
Yeah. And to put it into context, at the start of World War II, it was the fastest and most heavily armed fighter the RAF had in its portfolio, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes.
Yet we don't hear anything about it. And as you say, you know, at the moment, there's a great deal of news coverage of the celebrations of the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. I've not heard mention once of this aircraft. I must say the Hurricane struggles to get onto the platform,
yeah.
but not the Whirlwind.
No, I can't detract from this bit, right? It's the most beautiful aircraft, and I'd love to see them flying.
Yeah.
But, there is certain aircraft that are missed out.
Yeah. And did the Whirlwind have any active service in the Battle of Britain?
No.
Okay.
It was on the RAS strength.
Yeah.
But they were held in reserve up in Scotland.
Right. Okay. Okay.
It didn't actually take part.
So the aircraft's being designed. I suppose the next step is the major one, and that's building it. Where are you planning to do all this work?
Well, Mike Eastman, as I said, runs the aircraft restoration group. He's had a workshop in Ripley.
Yeah.
He's just moving to Fishburne Airfield just up at Durham.
Right,
he's
okay.
Have a purpose-built hangar. And that is where it's going to be built.
Right, okay.
We've got the best part of the rear fuselage constructed, apart from a bit of fettling. He's now got to put the planking on that.
Where's the money coming from, Chris? That's the, I'd say the $64,000 question, but I'm sure there's probably a little bit more than that needed.
Yeah. We've had a lot of donations from people. We're running a crowdfunding thing on JustGiving at the moment that's raised some money.
Yeah.
And generally it's from people that support the project.
How can people find out about it if they want to contribute, get involved, or monitor how you're doing?
Well, if they go to whirlwindfighterproject.org, that is our website.
Right.
There is a donate button there. They can follow also on Facebook, which is Westland Whirlwind Fighter Project.
Yep.
I also do a newsletter that goes out on the first of every month.
Okay.
And that's on a blog.
Okay.
But there is a link to that on the Facebook page and the project website.
Excellent. And Chris, the timetable then, when can we expect to see one of these wonderful ladies back in full regalia?
I think it's a bit like how long is a piece of string. We can fund things as we get the money.
Yeah.
We haven't given ourselves a timetable. I expect, like all things within the aviation world, it's going to take a few years. I would think somewhere around another sort of 3 or 4 years before we actually see things start to take place.
Well, we're very excited about it. I'm now have this aircraft back on my radar, as they say. And I do remember that Airfix model more years ago than I probably should say on air. But let's see if we can try and get it in front of some other people who have probably never heard of it. So, Chris, thank you very much for coming onto the program.
You're welcome, Peter. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, good luck. And do come back sometime and let us know how you're getting on.
I'd love to. Thanks very much.
So hopefully you know a little bit more about the Whirlwind now and can support Chris and the team with this excellent restoration project. The website again is whirlwindproject.org.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Jo Ayres is well known to many aviation fans with her presence on social media, but I wanted to get to know a little bit more about Jo, her love for the Vulcan, her voluntary roles, and of course, her photography. I'm with Jo Ayres and I've been looking to speak to Jo for some time. Social media queen, I think you've been described as. Very active on social media, but you've got a really interesting portfolio of things you do and I wanted to talk to you about it. But Jo, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. Very good to be with you today.
Jo, tell me how you got into aviation. What is it that interests you about flight?
In the great scheme of things, I'm actually quite new to the aviation world. I got into aviation seriously about 4 years ago, and that really does come down to the Vulcan and XH-55A, where I saw her flying at Farnborough, started an interest with her on social media, and they were looking for volunteers to work, and I thought, actually, I'd quite like to be a bit more involved in that. And, you know, the history of her and what she'd done. So I put myself forward, was invited for one of my first air shows was at Farnborough in, must have been 2012. So that shows really how new I am to it. And part of that experience is they let the volunteers out on the runway when XH-555 takes off.
Right.
And that sold it to me. It was an overwhelming experience. And alongside that, I just met fantastic people that day that have become friends from there on. So that opened the door to aviation and it just grew from there. I was hooked.
Okay. So let me talk about the Spirit of Great Britain. You're involved there. You volunteer now. What do you do for the Trust?
I'm a regional fundraiser for what we call South Central, which is covering Surrey and Sussex and Hampshire. And that was involved in taking the merchandise stand around to different events and selling the merchandise, raising the profile on social media. Alongside that, I'd also support the Trust because there's the club side of the Trust as well. So I'd work with the club, with the regional stand, but I'd also work with the Trust at the bigger events, the Vulcan Village, right, going around the air shows.
So what is it that really appeals to you about the Vulcan and that particular aircraft? Why does it appeal? What is it? What is it that makes that aircraft so special?
I think I'm fascinated with the history that she's had with the Falklands. I find that very interesting. I think that's because as I was the age when I was growing up, Falklands was in the news a lot. So that meant quite a lot to me. She's just such a grand aircraft. And just to watch her fly, she's just absolutely magnificent. And I think probably like some people say, like Marmite, love or hate her. But I've just found her absolutely fascinating. And alongside that is the people that are involved in the Vulcan, the crew, the engineers, people in the Trust, absolutely wonderful people. And I've really enjoyed working alongside them.
Yeah. When you say the words Vulcan and XH-558, your name often comes up. So you've been very active. Obviously, we enter the last year of her service. Have you seen her for the last time now?
Hopefully not. I did go to see her at the Shuttleworth Collection for her final display on the Sunday just gone. I went as public. I didn't want to go as a volunteer. I really wanted to sit back and enjoy the day. And it was absolutely overwhelming. And I cried a lot more than I actually thought I'd cry. I'd have members of the public I didn't know coming up and cuddling me and thanking everybody for what we'd done. But I actually hope to see her for the final time flying this weekend on her tour when she flies over Farnborough.
That probably goes before this goes out. What then is the future for you and that aircraft?
I would hope to have some kind of contact still. The Trust have asked me to be involved with arranging some talks and raising the profile of the academy that they hope to be working with. I'd like to also, Vulcan aside, work more on my photography, but I am having opportunities being offered to me to work with other aircraft. So there's a lot of opportunities coming forward and it's just deciding which direction to go with.
How lucky. Let's talk about your photography. Again, I think this is something that's quite recent to you.
But
you've got a unique style. Mm. I like your style. It's got real feeling to it. What is it that you look for in your photography? What makes your photographs different? Because they feel different.
I know they're not the most professional photos. I just like to get over what I'm seeing, what I'm loving, and try and show something a little bit different if I can, that there's a bit of feeling and maybe history behind what I'm actually taking a photograph of. So if I can capture that, it's just really what I'm feeling about aviation. Yeah. If I can get that over in a photograph.
Now you've been published a few times.
I have, yes.
You've done pretty well, And you also seem to pop up in some places that get some unique angles and views of aircraft. Mm. Tell us a little bit about some of the locations and some of your special photographs that you've taken.
I think some of my favourites is down on Salisbury Plain, where the Army Air Corps fly. So I do spend a lot of time down there, and that's where I've learned a lot of my photography, and that's absolutely fantastic. But I am lucky, opportunities come, and I think that being on social media, people are willing to sort of offer you to go, and I will start to take up these offers and go, and I'm not afraid to ask now. I used to be, but I'm not afraid to ask, can I come along and, bring my camera?
Yeah.
And it just really grows from there, so I really do appreciate it. I don't take it, you know, for granted at all. And some of, I know a lot of that has come from working with the Vulcan. It gets you in, you know, I mean, example was Red Bull this year, working there with the Vulcan, but I was able to capture some really good pictures and got a double spread in Pilot magazine. You know,
it's amazing. It's amazing. You've done really well. And if that wasn't enough, you volunteer at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust. So tell us about what you do there.
That's, again, quite general, just working with the public, showing them around the aircraft. If possible, I work on the aircraft. I mean, obviously, I haven't got an engineering background, but if I can help wash one, you know, wash one down now and again. We've just got some scout helicopters in, so that's been quite enjoyable, cleaning them, helping cleaning them up and things. So, and that's local to me. And again, it's about the history behind what we hold at FAST Museum. It's absolutely fascinating, and I just love it.
All right. Well, you do give a lot. I got to say, you do give a lot. What's the future for Joe then, and aviation and aerospace? What are you looking forward to next?
As I say, I'd like to work on my photography a bit more, and I'm self-taught. I don't really, you know, I'm a bit of a aim and click person, so I'd like to improve my skills, but not lose what I feel I can offer in a photograph. And as I say, look for a project that I can throw myself into wholeheartedly, carry on with FAST because that is local, and I would like to maybe offer them a bit more time. Now I'm not with the Vulcan, but as I say, there's been, you know, a few offers, maybe the Mosquito, there's a few, you know, the Shuttleworth collection, a few things that could possibly Bronson thought,
And Joe, where can we find you online?
I can be found on Twitter. I'm Airs Joe on Twitter. And on Facebook, under Joe Appleairs. And I'm happy for anyone to connect with me if there's an aviation link.
All right, we're going to watch out for you. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of all our listeners for all the work you have done, and particularly for the work you've done with the Trust.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the Society and the world at large and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
We've now got that review of Hawker Hurricane Survivors. Hawker Hurricane Survivors is a hardback book from the Grub Street Publishing Stable, and it's written by Gordon Riley. It's 224 pages of words and lots of great photos. Now, the first thing I want to get out of the way is the cover and the size. Some on social media have already commented about the cover, and the comments revolve around the font and the use of the lowercase letters in the title. I'm not a graphic designer, but until it was pointed out, it really didn't bother me at all. Secondly, the size and the shape of the book In old currency, it's roughly 8 by 10 inches, which on my shelf makes it slightly different, but in its own way, attractive. And in that way, it does give the book some character. Okay, so that's the cover and the appearance done. Now, if you're a Hurricane fan, then this book definitely has to be on your shelf. When I first saw the title, I really misunderstood the book completely. This isn't a book about flight stories and the Battle of Britain, although of course its release does coincide with the 75th centenary of that event. This book, as it clearly says on the front, is a complete catalogue of every existing known hurricane today. I, like probably many others, overlooked the Hawker Hurricane in favour of the more glamorous and often more heavily publicised Spitfire, and whilst I've often been in this camp, this book has resurrected my interest and focus on the Hurricane itself. Now, the book took 30 years to research, and as I said, is the story of every known Hurricane airframe still around today. Now, I never knew a great deal about the Hurricane, as it was always overshadowed by the Spitfire. So, for example, did you know that the oldest surviving Hurricane, which served in 1939, is displayed in the Science Museum in London, and that the last ever produced still flies with the RAF Battle of Britain Memorial flight. So this book gives you that definitive history and the current status of all these surviving airframes, photos, manufacturing details, and of course the service details. It starts with a really great overview of the Hurricane's history. Of the 14,533 that were built, the last one was built in July 1944. Now, Gordon Riley, the author, describes the challenge of getting the histories of some of these aircraft in the book, and because many were cannibalised airframes, used as parts, and eventually finding themselves being restored themselves. So it's been a real challenge for him, and he has stories in the book from all over the world, including Canada, USA, and Russia, and they've all been really challenging research areas. I found that quite interesting, knowing how he tracked down some of these airframe details. Following this introduction, you're then taken through each airframe history with fantastic pictures. If you love aviation photography, there's some great stuff in there. The book does start with the British-built Hurricanes and then onto the Canadian-built survivors. Now, I love the stories from all over the world, such as Zulu 5252 in Russia and its journey, eventually discovered in a lake in 2003, and it's still sitting around awaiting funding for restoration. Just an example of the sort of detail that Gordon Riley has gone to. Then there's a section on unidentified airframes where it's not been able to formally identify the aircraft, and this includes one in the National Museum of the US Air Force with a very dubious history, according to the author. Now, the final section is on rumours of surviving Hurricane airframes around the world. So if you've got an interest or are a Hawker Hurricane fan, this book is a must-have for you. Now, what do I like and what I don't like about it? What I don't like about this book too much is the shape, but that's really, really being very, very picky. It's a big book, it's a heavy book, and you really feel like you get the value from your £25. What I do really like is reading a book about a subject I thought I knew something about, but realised I really, really didn't. What I also like is the photography. It's very, very pick-upable and put-downable if you like that sort of thing. But like me, you could quite easily read it from end to end in one long go. It's very easy to read. They're great historical records, and I just found it a really enjoyable journey. So, written by Gordon Riley, published by Grub Street Books, priced at £25, and well worth it. Now, we'll put links to it in the show notes, and I'll put the ISBN number in there for you too. So I hope that's given you an overview of that book. I've enjoyed it. It's a real asset on my shelf with the rest of my collection, and I'm really, really pleased I got the opportunity to get this book.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian. the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com. Oi, we know you're in there! They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Okay, now we have a talk with Neil McCarthy, airshow jet display pilot, Airbus, and now he has the Flight Sim Centre. We start by catching up with Neil's latest aviation exploits, and I also get the chance, given Neil's experience, to see what changes the UK airshow may expect after this summer's events. Neil, we last spoke a few years ago when you flew Gareth into the air day at Yeovilton, and we've also talked more recently about Spit for Hire, but it's been another hectic time for you. You certainly love to do it. But before we talk about the Flight Sim Centre, what are you flying these days? Are you getting much flying in?
Well, the short answer is probably no, not as much as what I would like to do, apart from the virtual stuff, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute. But we're having a bit of a year off. We've had a very busy 16, 17 years doing Jet Provosts and Hawker Hunter flying and that kind of thing. And time for a slight bit of a change. And I'm looking at new horizons, and I think I'm going to get another aircraft, which will be hopefully bring the speeds down a lot slower, should we say.
Right, okay. Well, let's park you fly in there, but in the last month or two, you've also stepped up to the mark. You've been an Airbus, the Yorkshire Airshow, the airshow director, or involved in the role there. What was that like?
That was a great experience. I mean, I've done a little bit before in the past. Obviously, when I was displaying my own aircraft, we did numerous small events around the UK. And obviously, that involved me being the air boss. But it's one thing being an air boss for yourself in your display. It's another thing doing it for a rather large air show.
Yeah.
And great fun, great experience. Thoroughly enjoyed the whole thing. And I'm glad to say it went off without any faults at all. So everybody was happy.
Neil, that's a lot of responsibility, though, isn't it? How do you come to be an airshow director?
Well, you're quite right. It's all down to having the experience. I mean, it's all laid out in the Cap 403, which the CAA regulates who can do what. And it makes it quite clear that you've got to have some kind of experience, preferably being a display pilot on the air show circuit, which, of course, I have for the last 16-odd years. So we've got a lot of time. And, of course, my experience and background is to do with jets and classic jets in the UK.
Yeah.
And that is one area which is very niche. A lot of people have piston time, propeller time, helicopter time. Not many people have a lot of jet time.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky in that respect, as in I'm slightly in demand, if you want to call it that, as there's not many people who prepare to travel around who aren't already actually flying in the display.
Yeah.
So it's just basically having the experience and the knowledge to do it.
Yeah, and we did recently see you in the press for not the greatest of reasons. And congratulations to you for putting in a very good word and bringing some sense to the situation. How do you see air shows and particularly air shows like the Yorkshire Air Show, which is not the biggest, but it sort of carries a bit of a punch, developing in the future? Do you think some of what we've seen in the last year or so is going to affect air shows in the future?
Well, officially, we still haven't had any real information from the CAA or the AAIB what recommendations there may be on the UK air show scene. We've still got to wait and see. No doubt there'll definitely be issues to do with insurances increasing, and I've already heard that happening now, which, of course, could have an effect with some operators and pilots and some air shows even, perhaps, potentially. We'll have to wait and see. But I think that's what's going to be the biggest issue, is going to be insurance. Regulation-wise, yeah, there'll be changes. There's going to be a public outcry for changes. What they're going to be, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
As you know, at the minute, Hawker Hunters are still grounded and all classic jets can't do aerobatics. But, you know, in fairness to the jets, it ain't a jet issue. It could have been a Spitfire. Are you going to ground them?
Yeah.
I doubt it, you know. So we've just got to wait till the report comes out, see what goes on there, and hopefully a level-headed decision will be taken. Yes, there will be change, but, you know, to be fair, we're so heavily regulated anyway. I can't imagine there's that much more really they can do without completely changing locations, which is going to be very difficult to do, or pushing them out over the sea. And you don't want to be doing that, because that's actually, in my opinion, more dangerous than having them over the land.
Why is that, Neil?
From a pilot's point of view, obviously, display over land, you do have many features that you can keep an eye on, you know. Whether it be a river or a bridge or whatever it might be, it's got all good, nice level horizon features. Once you go over the sea, you could be displaying over a blue sky with a blue sea and a slightly hazy day, and you get no horizon, and then it's incredibly difficult to do a nice, neat display, and very dangerous from a pilot point of view. There's just no horizon for when you're doing aerobatics upside down. It's very hard to do, very difficult. So you just got to keep an eye on that.
Didn't think of that, so thanks for that. But let's get on to the Flight Sim Centre. Just over a year ago, I started seeing lots of things on social media, boxes appearing in the northeast, and slowly something's evolved that's quite impressive, isn't it? What have you managed to set up now?
Well, we've been quite fortunate. I've always wanted to have something like this set up, a Flight Sim Centre, for a while, actually. So it's been in the back of the head. Yeah. The old cogs have been turning. And it's just a case of getting the right equipment, the hardware, the visuals. And it was just one of them things that just all seemed to happen at the right time. And I just thought, if I don't do it now, it'll never happen. And of course, in the Northeast, we are not particularly blessed with these kind of bits of equipment. They're all down south, but there's nothing up north or Scotland. So by chance came across a 737 airliner cockpit flight simulator, had a look at it, and I'd previously looked about four or five before this all around the UK, which didn't quite come up to standard for myself, and but came across one in Wales. That looks good. We'll have a bit go for that. So we purchased that one. Then we had the issue of trying to find a unit to put it in.
Yeah.
And had to go for a slightly bigger unit. So found we had a bit of space. So to be different from the rest of the country, decided to make a full sim sender. And we got ourselves an F-35 fighter jet plane, which is also a universal one. So
I do love you, Neil. Nothing you do is ever simple, but it always comes off really, really well. An F-35. Oh, so.
Yes. The good thing is, obviously, you know, future proofing wise, that aircraft is obviously not even in service yet. But when it is in service, it'll be there for 20, 25 years.
Yeah. Of course.
Probably the last manned fighter ever built, probably.
Yeah.
Have to wait and see. But that's the way it's going at the minute. After that, it'll be drones and whatever else. Because as we know, the pilot is the weakest link.
Yeah.
So go down the fighter jet route, get that one. And of course, like I say, because of by chance, the way the F-35 is designed, it can also lend itself to being a universal sim.
Yeah.
So we can put anything on there. So one of the scenarios we'll have.
Right. Okay. Is that why I see the Spitfire and things like that coming up?
Well, we do have a separate Spitfire one as well.
Okay.
Have three simulators. We have a 737-800 series next generation.
Yeah.
And we also have the F-35, which you can put anything on, i.e. a Red Bull Air Race around London or a Spitfire.
Yeah.
But we also have a dedicated Spitfire cockpit, full-size replica of a Spitfire, 6 foot by 4 foot. We are now getting an original replica Spitfire controls made up now, which will go inside of there.
Yeah.
And of course, with that particular cockpit at the minute, we're having the latest technology, the Oculus Rift virtual reality goggles. So when you put these goggles on, you're in full 4K, 1080p kind of stuff, you know, full HD Spitfire cockpit. So when you look left, there's your beautiful elliptical wing.
You look
all around over your shoulder. There's the tail behind you. It is the closest thing to flying I've ever come across from a flight simulation point of view.
Right. Okay. Neil, let me come back then to the 737. I want to ask you some questions. Did you put it all together? Because it looked like quite some piece of equipment.
I had to rebuild it back at the Newcastle location, but yeah. We were very fortunate, as in there'd been another guy down in Wales who had built, shall we say, 80% of the cockpit himself.
Right, okay.
And had been running it for a couple of years as a simulator from his house. So wow. The majority was built, but of course we had to go down there and yeah. disassemble it and then reassemble it and add more bits on and add on, you know.
Now, it's a fully capable 737-800, isn't it?
It is. Every switch works. Now, the only one that people are interested in, of course, is the seatbelt and no smoking. But that's all anybody ever wants. But yes, all the other ones do work.
Right, okay. Now, the next question I wanted to ask you, Neil, is how did you know how to fly the 737-800? How do you know how to set it up and everything like that? Are you a 737 qualified pilot?
I'm not, but I was, as you know, a CA-approved test pilot, and those yep. test pilots, they can fly anything.
Right,
no, it's a
okay.
good question. The short answer is it was about 8 months of studying yeah. and training and YouTube videos and that kind of stuff and
right.
the whole official Boeing procedures of how to fly this thing.
Right, okay. And it's very impressive. I've seen the graphics, and one of the things that comes across to me, having seen all the setup that you've got, is the visuals are very sharp and they're large. They seem very good. Have you done something a bit different there?
I wouldn't say a bit different, but this is when it comes back to being at the right place at the right time. Previously in the past, you couldn't get full HD projectors and yeah. this kind of stuff. You know, no expense has been spared. The PCs are £2,000 each, and you're talking three or four to yeah. run the 737 alone. The projectors are £800 each. The screen was nearly £1,000 from America alone. It's special material to reflect the light for the projector to give it better quality image. The graphics card, £400 just on its own.
Yeah.
So the short answer is it's all top of the range, modern HD stuff, which we've put in there and we've tweaked it the best we can do. And I'm quite happy with the result, to be honest. Yeah, it's very good. It's very clear and very realistic.
And the reports coming back already, I've seen a lot of write-ups, independent write-ups. We're not, you know, blowing smoke here.
No.
Been very, very impressive. Tell us about what you can do, how much it costs and how we can find you.
Well, we're obviously on the internet, which is www.flightsimcentre.com. And we're on Facebook, Flight Sim Centre on there, and Twitter as well, which is Flight Sim NE. So that's how you can get a hold of us and contact us. Price-wise, the 737 starts, well, for 1 hour, is £89.
Wow, so that's pretty impressive.
It's very competitive to the best of anything else in the UK, very competitive.
Right.
So we're not here to make fortunes.
Yeah.
It's just really to try and educate people, entertain them, get them involved in flying and just have a good time, really. It's a good entertainment package. That's what we want to do.
And Neil, is there any, the 737-800 NG, is it possible to use formally in any accredited training, in any hours building?
Officially at this time, it's not. The sim is quite capable of doing that, along with the correct software. But at this time, we haven't gone for CAA accreditation.
Right.
And that's simply down to the cost involved and the man hours involved in creating manuals and that kind of thing. But certainly in the future, you know, if there was a market for it, and I'm not sure if there is one up north just yet, but if a market appeared for it, then definitely we could do that and probably would do that.
Yeah, okay. Now, physical accessibility, you're not far from Newcastle Airport, are you? So if people are travelling in, you could make a day of it.
Yeah, I mean, we actually do a collection delivery service from the bus stop, from Newcastle Airport, or from the metro or the train station. So we can collect and deliver customers should they want to travel up to see us. We have a special deal on at the minute. For £139, you can have the entire sim sender to yourself with an instructor if you want him for £139, two hours, and you get to fly all the simulators, the Spitfire, the F-35 or whatever you want it to be, and of course the 737, or maybe 2 hours just in 737. That's your choice. It's your 2 hours.
And with Christmas coming up, Neil, are you doing vouchers for for presents and things like that? Is that something that you do?
Absolutely, yes. We do vouchers and presents all the time. We have a special deal for lads and dads, we call it, for, you know, you can never buy things for the dads and the sons, can you really? So it's all good for that. And the good thing is at the minute we're doing, which we'll get to in a minute, I'm sure, is something called a Flyathon for the Great North Air Ambulance. And any vouchers we sell from basically now till Christmas, the Christmas vouchers, we're going to donate 20% of all sales back to the Great North Air Ambulance.
Wow, wow. Well, tell us about the Flyathon. It happened just about this time that this will air. So we're hoping to get it beforehand. But if not, tell us about what you're up to there.
Well, the plan is, yes, as you may know, in the simulator world, there's a few things called World Flight, which starts sort of down in Australia, and you basically get in a 77 simulator and you fly around the world over a course of a week.
Yeah.
And numerous people around the country and the world take part. They donate as they do that. And it's a similar format, basically. We're going to start 8 o'clock Saturday morning, and we're going to take off from Newcastle, and we're just going to fly around England, Europe, back to Newcastle after 24 hours. And the idea being every hour there will be a new person, a new pilot, and they have to have no experience as well. They don't have to be a pilot. Anybody can do it. Come along, donate some money to the charity, not to us, straight to the charity. And we take them for a flight. They get to fly a 737 airliner, and the charity makes, hopefully, quite a bit of money.
Oh, well done. Well done, Neil. And then finally, just before we wrap up, you recently were at the Flight Sim show as well. And again, there was a lot of attention and focus there. What was that like?
That was very good, actually. I didn't know that's my first one I've attended, either as a, you know, as a punter through the door and also exhibiting. And I've got to say, it was great. It was incredibly well attended. Obviously, Cosford's a great event to hold it as well.
Yeah.
And a company like Just Flight and PC Pilot Magazine sponsored the whole thing. And that's great for them, because it was a good thing to do. A load of people turned up, load of free software. I read one report, some guy bought a ticket the day before for £10 to get in, and he walked home with £140 worth of free software.
Right, so okay.
He was well happy.
Well, we're looking to do some more stuff on flight sims and that sort of sector of the business, so we're going to get you back. Neil, I know you're very busy. We've taken you away from your day job. I hope the line hasn't been too tricky to talk about. Where can we find you online? We've talked about the Flight Sim Centre. Are we following you through that, or?
That's as good a place. I mean, I'm on Facebook as well, Neil McCarthy. Yeah. Obviously, more than welcome there for people to, you know, come along and befriend me. Absolutely no problem at all. But yeah, the Flight Sim Centre is the main point of contact.
Right. And any more plans to restore any aircraft? I know that's also been a cycle that's probably a few years around, so I would expect to see Neil buying something soon.
Yeah, not restore, but it might have two wings, let's put it that way.
All right, well, watch this space. Neil McCarthy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
As always, great to talk to Neil, and apologies about the first few seconds of that interview. If you can support his 24-hour Flyathon, go over to the website, that's flightsimcentre.com, all one word.
Email us now. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, that's just about all for this extra episode, but before we go, we've had some good feedback on our survey. There's a few weeks left to complete the survey, so please do help us shape the programme moving forwards. We did ask for open and frank feedback, and we're certainly getting it, so if you've got a view, share it with us there, then there'll be a link in the show notes for this episode. We'll be back in a few weeks' time with another full episode. It's going to be an aviation history focus in the next episode. So if you've got a particular question or comment you want us to look at, send it to getinvolved@aviation-extended.co.uk or through Twitter or Facebook. You can always record us a short piece and we'll put it into the show. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the programme today. You can find Extended now on Stitcher.com, UKPodcast.com, ThePodDirectory.com, and, of course, iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find us at www.aviation-extended.co.uk, and there's no leading E on extended. You can also find us on Twitter. We also have a Facebook page as well, so come over and visit us there, Aviation Extended, again, all one word. And with the arrival of the music, on behalf of Gareth Stringer and Tim Robinson, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
This is XTP Media.